Hi, it's Tom here. And before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has donated to us this year. It's been one of Spiked's best years yet. We're reaching more people with our pro-freedom, anti-killjoy message. And it's all thanks to you, to our readers and listeners, for reading and listening and sharing and, crucially, donating. All of Spiked's content is free. We want to keep it free. And it's your donations that allow us to do that. So if you have supported us this year, thank you very much. And if you're a Last Orders listener and you haven't yet donated to Spiked, why not give us a gift this Christmas? It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and click the big red donate button in the top right corner. One-off donations are brilliant, but even better is a monthly donation. Just £5 each month can make a huge difference and keep us going and growing into 2020. So that's spiked-online.com. and the big red donate button in the top right corner. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden discuss the latest in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. In this, our final show of 2019, we're joined by Rob Lyons to discuss how foreign aid money is being wasted on nonsense nanny state projects. We'll discuss whether we're headed for a smoke-free world, and we'll take a look back on some of our favourite stories from 2019. Hello and welcome to this special end of year edition of Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the IEA's Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hello and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. And today we're delighted to be joined by Spiked columnist and science and technology director of the Academy of Ideas, Rob Lyons. Thanks for coming on the show, Rob.
And happy new year to you, Tom.
So we're going to talk about a few news stories as we normally do before going on to these two for their reflections on the year, some of their favourite moments, some of their maddest claims, maddest studies. But to kick things off, let's talk about a new report that's come out, published by the IEA, on the nanny state on tour. So this report, written by Mark Tovey, reveals that millions of the UK's foreign aid budget is being spent on nanny state projects. UK taxpayers have spent around 44.6 million on these projects between 2005 and 2018. And not only are they funding the kind of patronising programmes you can imagine, teaching imams in Bangladesh to preach about the evils of smoking, or projects to reduce the amount of salt used by Chilean housewives, a lot of the money has been staying here in the UK, just funneled into academic research projects here in Britain. So Chris, to kick things off, could you tell us a little bit more about this report and some of the examples in it? Because I guess this is an area that we haven't really touched on before.
Yeah, it's not really. I mean, the foreign aid budget is enormous. I think it's about £14 billion a year, and it keeps going up because it's fixed to GDP. It has to be 0.7% of GDP committed to foreign aid. Foreign aid is very controversial. It's very unpopular, and surveys, you know, consistently show that it's like the lowest priority pretty much for the British public. It's the one area they're quite happy to see reduced, if not cut entirely. And there are regular stories in the press about how this money is wasted or siphoned off to dictators or spent on the Ethiopian Spice Girls and all the rest of it. And what Mark did in this paper was to see how much of it was being diverted towards what we might call nanny state projects. Last year, there was a study came out from the University of York about the Chilean sugar tax, which we may even have discussed on the podcast at the time. I can't remember. I certainly wrote about it because it was a particularly weak study. And they left the evidence that the sugar tax had effectively done nothing in plain sight. They showed you a graph showing sugary drink consumption before and after the tax. And it was very obvious that although there were peaks and troughs, it hadn't gone down at all. And the authors even say this in the paper. They say, yeah, to the naked eye, you probably see that actually there's nothing really much going on here. However, when we ran this through a model, actually there was a 22% decline or something crazy like this. And I didn't really think any more of it until I read the draft of Mark's paper, Nanny State on Tour, and found out that this pathetic study had been funded from the foreign aid budget. And the amount was astonishing. £350,000 had gone into this. I don't know whether researchers ever even went to Chile. They certainly didn't need to, and I would guess probably didn't. And there's a lot of stuff like this going on. Because the foreign aid budget is so massive, people don't miss a few tens of millions here or there. This is one of the problems of it. And I think that, and Mark kind of explains this in economic terms in the paper, but I mean, this is not money well spent. He looks at all the things you could be doing with that money in terms of bang for buck, of saving lives, of, you know, cleaning water supplies, of giving people anti-malarial nets and stuff like this. And it's nearly anything like that would be more effective and have more an effect on reducing disease and poverty than looking into sugar taxes. Or, I mean, one of my favorites was £800,000 spent getting imams in Bangladesh to warn about secondhand smoke in mosques. And it was some sort of kind of randomized control trial in which some of these imams would preach about secondhand smoke and some of them wouldn't. And then they'd go around, the researchers would go around people's houses and see how much people were smoking in them. You know, unbelievable waste of money, really, particularly when you consider the kind of problems that Bangladesh has got as a very poor country. By contrast, Chile's actually a pretty rich country. It's the richest country in South America. It's in the OECD. And yet foreign aid money is being used by Western academics up in York to run through some spreadsheets and come out with some junk science. So there's loads of examples like that in paper, some of it pretty mind-blowing stuff. And what does it show? I don't know. I think the main conclusion of interest to me, I think, is this kind of academic capture, the way that these academics – well, one of them, by the way, is Graham McGregor from Action on Sugar, who we discussed many times on the podcast before. He's managed to get a lot of money from foreign aid to try and cut down on salt consumption in China. So there's a lot of kind of vested interests at work here. A lot of academics are funding themselves for a good while with money that people naively think is being spent on poverty reduction and disease reduction in the third world.
And am I right in thinking that part of the reason is that it's not just DFID who can hand out this money at this point?
Yeah, that's one of the issues you raise, is actually quite interesting. I didn't know this, but in recent years, foreign aid, maybe because there's so much of this money now, like DFID can't physically spend it all itself. Some other departments have started having a foreign aid budget of their own, Department for Business, for example, and of course the Department for Health. And yeah, if you look at the Department for Health, they're under no legal constraints to spend this money on poverty reduction, unlike DFID. That's one of the differences. And so it seems that they've just been handing the money out to their mates pretty much.
Rob, what did you make of all this?
Well, there's always, yeah, as Chris says, there's always been a problem with foreign aid, and the usual kind of criticisms are that there's no obvious thing to spend it on, and so it's a pot of money that's just sitting there to be available to useless causes, or that it's used to basically subsidise groups at home. So America is classically famous for using its foreign aid budget to buy excess corn and prop up prices in America and send it to countries whether they really need it or not, or whether that's the best way of solving their food crisis or whatever. But this just seems to be like a perfect shitstorm of two things coming together. No useful purpose for this money other than having to set a target and grandstand on the world stage about, oh yes, we do our 0.7% of GDP. And a bunch of academics who have always been sniffing around for bits and pieces of money and have discovered a pile of it that they can use and abuse. And as Chris says, I mean, the results are staggeringly useless, but do prop up that whole industry here in the UK of public health junk science.
And Chris, you touched on this earlier, but is there something quite strange as well about how if there were to be kind of international public health projects, you'd assume it would be about things like communicable diseases and all the rest of it? I mean, it almost comes back to something we've talked about before on this podcast, whether it's, you know, the World Health Organization seem to, you know, be praising dictatorships for bringing their obesity rate down rather than actually seeming to care about Ebola or things like this. Is this a pattern that we're seeing across the board, really, that, you know, what should be going into what we would all understand to be kind of international public health problems is getting funneled into lifestyle issues?
Yes. One of the problems with having very large pots of money to distribute to the world's poor by whether it's, you know, DFID or the WHO, is that Western do-gooders tend to be the ones who are distributing it, and it tends to be their priorities that rise to the top. Michael Bloomberg, a great example of this, you know, he's literally a billionaire. He is spending a huge amount of money on so-called public health stuff, but it's not the stuff that's actually saving young people from dying of communicable disease in Africa. It's campaigning for sugar taxes in Mexico or what have you. So when it's Western do-gooders who are controlling the purse strings, there's a danger that it will be their priorities and their own, you know, fetishes and fads and obsessions that run the show and create the agenda. So, yeah, it is a problem. And the people who are both distributing this money and who are effectively spending it or receiving it, they would argue that, you know, preventable non-communicable diseases are on the rise in developing countries. And that is true. And I'm not making light of that. It's obviously, it would be better if everybody lived to the age of 100 or any disease at all. But a hell of a lot of deaths in these countries are still from communicable disease. And they're not people dying of lung cancer or heart disease at the age of 80. They are people dying at the age of 8 from diarrhea or malaria or what have you. And it just seems to me obviously a different case. And until we've got somewhere close to eradicating communicable disease in these countries, I don't think there's any justification for spending it on salt reduction and anti-smoking programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the case of Africa and malaria is very clear. You mentioned Mark Tovin notes that the money from one particular project would buy 3 million anti-malarial nets in Africa. And that's been a big success story over the past decade. It's just a really determined international effort to deal with this problem, and it has had very direct consequences. I mean, and just looking at, you know, sanitation as well, just the inability to have clean water and a clean place to go and have a crap, frankly, mm-hmm. Is not something that's available to at least hundreds of millions of people and probably billions of people. And it's relatively cheap to deal with those things. So why on earth they're spending money on, in relatively rich countries, as you said, Chile and Mexico are relatively rich countries compared to many other parts of the world, when they could save so many more lives by these very, very simple and very cheap measures. So that gives people the opportunity to die from a non-communicable disease at the age of 70 rather than die from some, you know, horrible riverborne virus at the age of 13.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. Next up, let's talk about smoking and the attempts to carve out or move us towards a tobacco-free world, and whether or not we're going to have any choice in that matter. So we talk a lot on this podcast about smoking, about the war on smokers, about various different kind of, you know, miserable policies which are trying to edge us away from tobacco products. But we rarely kind of talk about the bigger picture, I guess. And this is the subject of a report that you published recently with Forrest, Rob, taking that broader view, looking at how policymakers are talking about eradicating tobacco products, the role that things like e-cigarettes and heated tobacco is playing in all this. And also this interesting response we're starting to see from tobacco companies like Philip Morris openly saying that they themselves don't want to sell tobacco products and or cigarettes in particular by 2030. So Rob, do you want to tell us a little bit about where we're at with the kind of war on smoking and the war on smokers? Are we headed towards that tobacco-free world that policymakers and now some business people talk about?
So we've obviously had decades of attempts to clamp down on smoking, very much accelerated in the last 20 years with advertising bans, you know, public smoking bans, plain packs and all that. But in recent years, we've also seen the rise of alternatives to traditional cigarettes as a means of getting nicotine. Most obviously is e-cigarettes, which have proven to be very, very popular. And perhaps more recently, what seems to be a genuinely successful attempt to produce a heat-not-burn product. So heat-not-burn products, which warm tobacco up enough to produce a vapor, and that supplies the nicotine, rather than smoke, which in the process of burning tobacco, that's the thing that provides all the carbon monoxide and carcinogens and stuff that actually cause ill health if you persist in smoking for decades. These are much, much safer. And earlier attempts just never took off, but with Philip Morris have produced IQOS, which is and has proven to be very, very popular. And I know plenty of smokers or people who stop smoking and start again and stop smoking and start again who have quit by switching to IQOS completely. So we have this fantastic situation where alongside traditional cigarettes, we now have real choice about alternatives to that that give you the same sort of ritual of, and hand movements and things that people like about smoking. And there's a bit of a routine to using them, which is nice. So that's all good. But this is in the context of continuing attempts to crack down on smoking. And there is a stubborn sixth of the population, maybe, who just prefer tobacco cigarettes. And I think while we have that choice, we should also defend the choice of people who want to just carry on smoking.
But at the same time, I think it's fair to say, Chris, that there's not many people beyond people in this room and a few other people we know willing to stand up for that. And it does feel that even as all these alternatives are coming into play, still the direction of travel is towards more and more controls. I mean, you've written the book on prohibition. Do you think that's where we're going to head to eventually? Is that really what could be on the horizon in terms of cigarettes and...
Oh, yeah, eventually, definitely. It's just a question of when. I think there'll be some country somewhere will bring in a prohibition, and whatever happens under prohibition, you'd obviously have to have a pretty low smoking rate before you'd even attempted it, but whatever happened in terms of the black market and the unintended consequences, studies would appear in The Lancet and elsewhere saying this has been a wonderful success and saved loads of lives, and then it would be a case of, oh, well, we need to be following whatever country this is. Let's say it's Thailand. You know, the UK needs to follow Thailand's lead. The EU needs to follow Thailand's lead. And it would snowball from there. I don't know if 2030 is a realistic time frame for that. The government evidently thinks that or expects vaping to continue to get more and more people to switch so that by 2030, there are fewer than 5% of the population smoking. That's their definition of a smoke-free country, less than 5% of people. It's still quite a few people, obviously, but probably so few that you're not going to get much resistance. You probably wouldn't get that much resistance if you did it now, such as the kind of inability of smokers to defend themselves and the attitude that you get from not non-smokers per se, but certainly from the government and the anti-smoking groups, and the idea that's endlessly hammered home that, you know, smokers are deviants and very unusual and all desperate to quit smoking. So of course it will happen eventually. It's not going to go the other way, is it? The alternative is that suddenly everybody relaxes about smoking and everyone says, you know, it's up to you. You're a grown-up, do what you like. That's obviously not going to happen.
I mean, one of the things that inspired the book, which was a couple of years in the making, was at the time when e-cigarettes were becoming very popular, and it was in question whether, in fact, there would be some kind of crackdown on them at the UK level. And certainly a lot of the anti-smoking groups and cancer research and people like that were very anti-vaping, and they were won over by the harm reduction argument by various sensible people. But one of the things was that these groups did have a tendency to go, oh, we're not smokers and we're not big tobacco and we're nothing to do with that. And therefore, you know, crack down on those people if you like, but just leave us alone. It was a trend within that movement. There was plenty of other people who were ex-smokers who were very, very keen to make the case of choice as well, in fairness. But that was a bit of a tendency as well. And it's those little battles that then go on over which form of nicotine you're promoting. So again, there is the question over whether, for example, Big Pharma is helping to promote anti-vaping arguments, particularly in America, because obviously if you want to quit traditional cigarettes, your choices at the moment are e-cigarettes, really, or pharmaceutical substitutes, you know, nicotine gum and patches and whatever. And that's a big market. And you know, they're feeling under a threat. So there may be some money going into that from those things. So there's all these different battles going on, hence the title Nicotine Wars, and not very much discussion about maintaining choice for everyone, whatever they want to do.
And Chris, just finally, in the context of this new panic that we're seeing about vaping, particularly in the US, we've talked about it a lot on this podcast, but it's already starting to filter through to the UK a bit, I think it's fair to say. Is that going to make the kind of campaign against traditional cigarettes and tobacco that little bit more fierce? It's like, we tried this other alternative, but actually it is prohibition that's going to be the way forward.
I'm not sure about that as such. I mean, I think they're going to push towards prohibition of cigarettes regardless. I think actually it makes it quite a lot easier for the government if they've already got loads of people who have already voluntarily switched. So I think the UK government's position is, from their perspective, pretty sensible and pragmatic, if you accept their ultimate goal, which I don't. What's happened in recent weeks is that the moral panic in America, which kind of ended with a bit of a fudge, really, which Donald Trump initially said, okay, we're going to get all these flavored products off the shelves. And then he turned around and said, actually, I think there's a big danger here that people turn to the black market, and a problem that was caused by black market vapes is going to get worse. So at least he gets it eventually. That's since spread to Canada. So they've had exactly the same kind of panic over in Canada, and they're going to ban flavored vapes by the look of it. And even in Ireland, they haven't actually had any cases of anybody hospitalized there, but you've got the terrible nanny states in Ireland are pushing for a ban on flavored e-cigarettes. So, I mean, definitely vapors are on the back foot at the moment. What happened in America shows that you can really just create entirely your own narrative based on nothing but lies, really, and go after vaping, and everybody will fall for it pretty much. So you feel kind of helpless when you've got such powerful forces against you. And Public Health England and the UK government has so far, you know, held the line on that. But I think they're probably feeling increasingly cornered. The momentum is definitely with the anti-vaping people.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And even if there were a smoking ban, at some point somebody's going to turn around and say, oh, it's only 95% safer, so it's not safe at all. And like, this could mean hundreds of deaths every year or whatever, and make some spurious argument about vaping. So, you know, there's always the possibility that these things come around and bite you on the ass somewhere down the line. Just as an aside, I just think the Philip Morris thing is really interesting as an example of the woke corporation, where more and more the people who get to middle management, upper management levels in big business have come through with these ideas, whether it's from university or wherever, just in the ether. So Philip Morris doesn't want to be a tobacco company anymore, or at least doesn't want to sell cigarettes that you burn. BP wants to be Beyond Petroleum. Unilever is the most right-on corporation of them all.
Sainsbury's is putting Frosties on the top shelves. Do you see that? It's always Sainsbury's, they're the worst one.
So there are all these tendencies where choice is being taken out of our hands by people who, from the companies themselves, so much for them being completely driven by profit. But on the other hand, it's nice to know that when they do things like this, the new ad age, you know, go woke, get broke, they very often screw up and they misunderstand their own customer base.
But they don't always go broke. This is the trouble. What they often do is they introduce these stupid voluntary policies, and then when they lose money to their rivals, they push the government to make these policies mandatory. Mm. You know, that's what you're getting with this potential ban on sale of energy drinks to kids, for example. Most of the supermarkets, you know, last year when Jamie Oliver started bitching about it, said, okay, we'll start IDing people who won't sell these drinks to people under the age of 16. And now they are lobbying the government for a total ban.
Are you looking for the perfect gift this Christmas for your most pro-Brexit, pro-freedom loved ones? Then look no further than Spike's online shop. We have t-shirts, hoodies, mugs and tote bags sporting all of your favourite Spike slogans, from ban nothing, question everything, to love Europe, hate the EU. We even have some new designs coming very, very soon. So to have a look at the range and to make your purchases, just go to spiked-online.com and hit the dark blue shop button in the top right corner. Now, back to the show. So in this final section, we want to take a look over the year, discuss some of the maddest studies, the most insane claims, or just some of the most significant moments in nanny state news from 2019. Also, perhaps a bit of a view to talking about how the battles might shape up in the year to come. So, Rob, do you want to kick us off in a kind of quite crowded field? What stuck out to you this year?
Well, my two sort of obsessions in terms of writing over the last little while are nanny state stuff, hence I'm here, and climate change. And this year, spectacularly, these two things came together in the Eat Lancet Commission. You know almost certainly that anything that's really, really terrible on this front is going to have been instigated by the Lancet, which has long since ceased to be any kind of recognisable.
Andrew Wakefield's Lancet, as I call it.
So what this commission did, which is bringing together just really all the most dreadful people in both fields, is to try and come up with some kind of dietary guidelines that would be both healthy and would save the planet. And the result is, you know, I wrote in January, was the incredible inedible diet. It's things like you can have a whole ounce of chicken per day, 28 grams, a wondrous 1.5 eggs per week, and just 50 grams of potato per day. And as I said, you know, my family are all from Ireland. How the hell would they have coped with just 50 grams a day of potatoes? And obviously they're then promoting the idea of eating lentils and chickpeas and basically not drinking any kind of sugary drink and all this stuff. And yes, you know, I mean, first of all, I don't believe it would save the planet anyway. But secondly, it would be an utterly miserable diet. It's kind of some kind of Amish idea of what, you know, the future of food should be. And it's just mad. And obviously, nobody in their right mind would actually eat this diet. So spectacularly just pointless exercise as well.
Chris, didn't you try to actually do a day on this diet at some point this year? Made a couple of videos about it. How did that go?
I made a few videos of it. I didn't eat what I made on video, I have to say. I would have been
behind
very hungry.
Curtain, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you just need to show people just how small these portions are, right?
What does half an egg look like?
That's my question. Exactly. I chopped up some ham and bacon and sausages and a bit of chicken. I mean, it's just a ludicrously tiny, tiny, tiny amount. So just showing what this diet looks like was really enough to kind of debunk it. The whole thing, the Eat Commission, I think it's called, it was all the brainchild of these billionaires, this billionaire couple from Norway, who then went jetting around the world promoting it and have since divorced or since split up fairly recently. There was something in The Lancet again, actually, very recently, about the social media response to this. There was a hashtag, Yes to Meat, set up a couple of days before the report came out. So somebody, mainly it was people in the low-carb, high-fat community who are always fairly vocal. They got the press release a couple of days before the report came out, and they not quite spiked it, but they got their shots in early. We're using this hashtag, Yes to Meat. And the Yes to Meat hashtag went pretty viral, according to this article in The Lancet. But it was all clearly just people who, you know, a bit obsessed with the paleo diet, a bit low carb, high fat, and don't shut up about it. And this study just kind of, like a lot of studies these days, it was just some researchers sat down and trawling through Twitter endlessly and looking at the tweets that were positive towards the diet on the hashtag and negative towards the diet on the hashtag, and the overwhelming majority were negative. And normally in these studies, there's this implication that the industry is somehow behind these. It's bots. It's an industry hashtag.
It's the Russians.
They just couldn't do it with this, because it's obviously just the same old people from the low-carb community banging on social media like they always do. So I don't even know what their conclusion was, really, in the study. It was just like something like, you know, scientists must be mindful of the possible backlash from people on social media. But it was very much as if they wish that people would not use social media at all. Like if only we could go back to the good old days when The Lancet published stuff, the media ate it up, and everyone trusted them.
So, Chris, I think I know what you're going to say, but what was your moment of this year?
Well, I want to end the final podcast of the year on a happy note. And we have discussed this before, but I think one more time for the road. Jamie Oliver, or Jamie Oliver's restaurants, or the Jamie Oliver Group, whatever it's called, went into liquidation back in the spring. It was a wonderful time to be alive. It'd been wonderful watching him slowly but surely be faced with the reality that people don't want to eat his food. Certainly not served at the prices that they were being served at in Jamie's Italian. My theory is that a lot of this was down to the fact that Jamie Oliver has made himself very unpopular with lots of people, but that could just be projection. But the important thing is that he went virtually bankrupt, or certainly that part of his business went bankrupt. People have said, oh, he put £13 million of his own money into it. Well, he'd just taken out £14 million in dividends from a failing business. So he's not really the saint that people are trying to make out. Presumably, he realizes if he'd just taken £14 million out of dividends from business was losing money, and he was just about to close it down and put thousands of people out of work, he might suffer some kind of reputational damage from it. You know, it's not like a lot of people think I hate Jamie Oliver, and I kind of understand why they would think that, because I do go on about him quite a lot. But I really don't. You know, there is a small number of people I hate, and who, if they died, I would be quite happy. But Jamie Oliver certainly is not one of them. I just think he's a dickhead. And that's all. I just think he's a dickhead, and the government and the media shouldn't pay so much attention to somebody who just doesn't know what he's talking about. And even this very clear confirmation that this guy is not producing food that people want to eat has not been enough to get him kind of kicked off the Good Morning Britain couch and all the rest of it. He's still continuing to be portrayed as a good guy. And the cloud to this silver lining is that he's now setting up what he calls, I think it's called an ethical B corporation. I don't know what it means, but it sounds like the kind of thing that might be eligible for lottery funding. And he's going to dedicate himself full time now to trying to halve childhood obesity by 2030. So in a way, this has backfired on me. In a way, it would be better if he was still putting out fires in his various failing businesses, because now he's stopped doing that. He's going to be even more political and even more in the bloody media than ever before, which is a great shame. But still, I've still got that moment of Shard Floyd from this year when it was confirmed and he was in tears when his business failed.
Rod, what did you make of all this? Because as Chris says, he's not necessarily going away, but it does mark a bit of an end of an era on some level of him being omnipresent in these discussions.
Well, I mean, he's it's that combination of that always doing food programs for Channel 4 to flog books. And that's, you know, that's where his wealth has really come from.
So, you know, he's a best-selling British non-fiction author of all time. If you count recipes as writing, right? Yeah. I don't know what's actually in his books. Presumably there's other stuff as well. Best-selling non-fiction author of all time.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
So so no doubt this will give him time to film Jamie's Romania or something and tell us all about the wonderful food that's produced there, and then he'll make a complete dog's dinner of it and the Romanians will complain, whatever. But yeah, he's still got that going for him, and he's still pretty popular in that respect. So you can see that something will come along that he will like attach himself to. And he, for some reason, people think that he's personally popular rather than the fact that his books are generally, you know, posh cooking for people like me who can't really be asked to do proper cooking. So like throw five ingredients together and, oh, look, it's a proper meal. He's popular at that level and remains, I think it will remain popular.
How popular is he? This is the thing that always gets me. I've hardly met anyone who doesn't think he's a knob.
I think that people do think he's a knob, but they will buy his books. And because he's near the top of the bestsellers list all the time and he's on TV all the time and he spouts stuff about things, then whenever they've got a policy that they want to push out, he will latch onto it. Everything he's ever said, somebody else said before, but much more quietly but with less profile. And he's picked up on it and made it his own, whether it's the school dinners thing or anything else. So I can absolutely see him doing something like that in the future.
Why won't he go away? He should have gone away so long ago. He should be, well, it was like the late 90s, wasn't it? He first shot to prominence.
Yeah.
He should have been a flash in the pan in the late 90s. And people now, if insofar as they remembered him at all, would say, do you remember that guy who was on the reality TV cooking program, whatever it was? And it would be like, you know, do you remember, you know, Why Does It Always Rain on Me by Travis or Nasty Nick from Big Brother or something like that? It's just, there's no rational reason why he should still be so prominent, let alone have £200 million. And none of it makes any sense to me. He's been forced upon us, as far as I can see. It's a bit like, it's not directly comparable. Like, you know how the BBC tells us that Claire Balding is like a national treasure? I don't know anybody who actually believes that. It just seems to me that they just decided they were going to push her to that prominence. And I've got nothing against Claire Balding, certainly not in the way I have against Jamie Oliver. But it just seems to me we're being told that these people are popular when they're not.
Yeah.
If you disagree, do send us an email and explain why you like Jamie Oliver.
And if Jamie's listening,
come on the show. Come on the show. Always
anytime.
Open.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If and only if you enjoyed it, be sure to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to keep Spiked fighting into 2020, please do consider making us a Christmas donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and click the big red donate button in the top right corner. Thanks so much and see you next year.